The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. I'm Andy Cahan, Director of Author Events. With an artist's perspective and a ground-level view of people and extremists across the globe, writer Anna Bodkin's immersive investigations of the world's inequities have yielded 7 books of nonfiction, including The World is a Carpet, 4 Seasons in an Afghan Village, Walking with Abel, Journeys with the Nomads of the African Savannah, and Fisherman's Blues, a West African community at sea. In Bright, Unbearable Reality, Bodkin offers 11 essays set across 4 continents that explore the human need for communion and meaning amidst the world's current emotional and political disruptions. Tonight, Anna will be in conversation with Ara D. Matthews, the Philadelphia Poet Laureate and co-director of creative writing at Bryn Mawr College. She is the recipient of a 2022 Academy of American Poets Laureate Fellowship. Her new collection of poems, Bread and Circus, will be published next year by Scribner. Please welcome Anna Bodkin and Ara D. Matthews.
Good evening, everybody. Thank you for coming out. Tonight we have the wonderful Anna Bodkin here to talk about her newest book, Bright, Unbearable Reality, which finds us in this current Anthropocene period. And it also finds us at a time when the planet is consumed by violence and breach between humans and by humans in a world that sustains them, but that they can also fear. And in the beginning of the book, we find Anna seeking hope in the cradle of humanity. And I was hoping you might open us up with a reading from the beginning of the book.
Sure. Thank you very much for coming. Thank you, Free Library of Philadelphia. Thank you, Era.
Of course.
A single person is missing for you, and the whole world is empty, writes Philippe Ariès. And each moment, at least one person is missing for millions of us, often out of reach, flung apart as we are, undone transcontinentally. The grief makes it impossible to move. This is aporia, an absence of path, a passagelessness that engenders a state of powerless, immobilized confusion, of being at a loss, a no way that is not the same as a presence, a separation of heart and will. Yet there is something else. The connections that may fade but never disappear, the gossamer threads of intimacy we float behind us as we disperse, the kinship that may be undone in time, but that our memories sustain as vivid, iridescent as a painted bunting's plumage. Picture the brief animation anthropologists sometimes use to demonstrate human impact on the planet, a pale, luminescent tapestry of roads, railways, pipelines, cables, air routes, and shipping lanes latticing a nighttime earth. Except, instead of physical infrastructure, imagine the other ways in which the Anthropocene connects us, the polythreaded, shimmering veil of yearning and missing and care and love.
Thank you so much. It was beautiful.
Thank you.
In the beginning of the book, and actually really throughout the book, it seems as if you're tracing origin while confronted with what seemed like the end of the world, thinking about the beginning of the pandemic. And I was wondering how important that introductory framing was for the book, the idea of the origin story. Because as I was reading it, I was thinking, well, you enter into an origin story one way, but you often come out of the other side in a completely different way than when you went in, thinking of Adam and Eve, if you will. Sure. And so I'm wondering if you might talk a little bit about the framing of the origin story.
Sure. What interests me in our existence. Well, mm-hmm. first of all, I'm going to say I'm a very anthropocentric person. Mm-hmm. I like humans a lot. I think we're very interesting. Yeah. We're very messed up, but we're really fascinating. So I really care about what we're doing with our planet and with ourselves and what our intentions are. Mm-hmm. And so the question I keep asking is, how do we... where do we go from here? And I think in order to figure that question, we need to ask the question of how did we get here in the first place? And so there's the entirety of the book, I think, explores, all the essays in the book, one way or another, explore this tension between our penchant for violence and our penchant for astonishment. Mm. So violence is how we are not getting to go anywhere. Right. And astonishment is how, I think, how we will. At least this is how, you know, this is, you know, I'll quote Galway Kinnell. He has a poem called The Hours, which he wrote for a student who had attempted suicide. Mm-hmm. And he has these lines. He says, "Trust the hours, haven't they carried you everywhere up till now?" So we are here because the hours have carried us here from the beginning of us. How? So that's kind of what I was looking for and probably continuously am looking for.
Yeah.
Is the how.
Is the how. And I'm thinking here about how to read the air, in that we're confronted with ways that nature sends us signs. So I'm thinking about the idea of astonishment that you just shared with us, and that we must be open to them. And so including those signs, you talked about the symbol of birds, which redirect the reader to start thinking about boundary, migration, patterns of movement. And here we're again confronted with this idea of the border, because borders aren't necessarily bad. Our body is a border. Our will is a border. Sometimes we have to assert ourselves. But they're very much configurations of human imposition and still very much configurations, the borders, the boundaries that we are presented with every day, very much configurations of possession. And so I'm wondering, how do we reconcile sort of the necessity of a border while acknowledging how dehumanizing a border might be?
Yes, and in general, how do we reconcile with this dichotomy of thinking?
Right.
Like this
right.
many-can thinking. It's a very Western thing, I think.
Truly.
To think that it's either one or the other. I think right. that's where we get stuck a lot.
Yeah.
That, you know, if it's not good, then it's bad. If mm-hmm. it's not bad, then it's good. Like that doesn't work in reality. The reality is everywhere, and it changes, and it's fluid, mm-hmm. and we're rigid, or we have this tendency to be rigid. Mm. You know, the essay that talks about augury, mm-hmm. reading the birds, also talks about racist police violence here in Philadelphia, about a very specific murder mm-hmm. of a young black man in my neighborhood by mm-hmm. racist cops. And, you know, this is on the heels of the conversation around separation of the bird watchers mm-hmm. and black people. Mm-hmm. Right, this idea of whiteness
right.
and bird watching
right.
in this country, right? And the boundary there. Mm-hmm. Birds actually don't give a shit about who watches them. Yes, exactly. They actually don't care if anybody watches them at all. They're right. doing their thing.
Right. Right.
So that too, right? These are created boundaries. Mm-hmm. And again, the boundaries of the boundaries are, you know, I grew up in the Soviet Union, mm-hmm. Which was a police state, and pushing against boundaries was kind of how you survived. Mm-hmm. So maybe I carry that instinct with me. Let's see if we pry this apart a little bit. What happens there?
Exactly.
What happens there?
Exactly. I love this idea that it doesn't have to be either or, right? It can be both. Can be both and.
Yes.
The idea of the boundary.
It can be all five.
Oh, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. All five.
Yeah.
And so I was also thinking about how you juxtaposed how to read the air against ways of seeing. Specifically, I found myself fascinated by, so there's a reverence of birds, right? And that they don't give a shit. They just do what they're supposed to do. And the bird's sight, but there's also this deep understanding of how violence is enacted through the aerial because you need some distance from it. So what sparked this interrogation into the perverse ways that we enact violence from afar? I hadn't seen that before. I hadn't thought of that before, in that you need some remove from the violence that you enact. And so when you watch it from an aerial point of view, the drone that enacts the violence can also take the picture of the violence. So thinking about that, like how...
Before and after.
Before and after. Yeah. So it's really seeing the beauty, the astonishment in the aerial of the bird, but also seeing the devastation of kind of these aerial devastations that we impose on one another. So how did you work through, bring those two images together? How did you work through that? What was it that connected them for you?
I remember trying to figure out when we began to depict ourselves from the air. Mm. So in ancient maps in which humans are present, I'm talking about really old maps,
sure,
thousands of years old, they're not necessarily aerial. Mm-hmm. They're kind of a combination. They're guides, and they're kind of a combination of vantage points. Mm-hmm. And at least in the European tradition, it was during the Renaissance that artists began to paint from this, God's eye view or bird's eye view, because they wanted to illustrate the pettiness, mm-hmm, of this earthly life, mm-hmm, right? And now we use, and then there exists a progression of depiction, and until fairly recently, we didn't see a whole lot of aerial images of humans. There were few, mm-hmm, historically. Often for military purposes, but often classified. Mm-hmm. But it was this commodification of images and this desire by Western audiences to have instant access to everything. Mm-hmm. This voyeuristic kind of need to see, mm-hmm, everything, and this idea that we're entitled to see everything, that was combined with the development of digital technology. Mm-hmm. So in the late 90s and early aughts, photographers from the front, for example, I was in Afghanistan during that, mm-hmm, those years, and I remember traveling with photographers who carried film cameras. Mm. And then they stopped carrying film cameras. Mm. And then they could send these images directly through a satellite phone, and they will be in the paper the next morning. And we wanted more of that. Mm-hmm. We wanted more pictures that are immediate. Now we don't even have to wait until the next morning. We just send it and upload it to Instagram. Mm-hmm. So this commodification of images... That is, you know, a very capitalist kind of idea. And at the same time, what I wanted to know is, what does it tell us about us that we are comfortable looking at other humans, never ourselves,
right,
other humans from this remove, mm-hmm, that says, oh my God, there's so many of them. or look at how big, you know, look at how long this line is to this refugee camp. Look at how long this line is to cross the border. Look at how many people. Look at how many dead people, mm-hmm. right? But without really being there and experiencing viscerally the grief that we probably should be experiencing.
Exactly. Exactly. Something about removing oneself from grief makes violence all the more devastating. If you can't grieve a violence, then it just becomes something so distant from you, right? It becomes something that doesn't feel real. It feels like it's enacted on others. And so there's something in what you said about kind of this delineation between us and them when you can watch devastation, but it's not impacting you in any way. It's a desensitization.
And also, it is perpetrated by others.
Right.
It always is. It's never us.
Right.
And we use words such as inhuman. But violence is extremely human. We've been doing this forever.
Right.
And it doesn't really evolve. Some weaponry evolves, but actually not so much.
Right.
The ways in which we hurt one another, especially physically, haven't really changed
mm-hmm.
because they're basically effective.
Right.
And because we're in denial. And we're surprised every time that there is, oh my God, how could this happen? You know, as we're living in a more and more violent world, these repetitions of, I can't be, unbelievable, inhuman. And that is also part of the kind of the puzzle that keeps violence going, because we're in denial.
Exactly.
We're doing
exactly.
It.
Yeah. And then also thinking about how, the book had me thinking about how violence perpetuates displacements to some degree. And if we aren't being displaced, if other people are being displaced, it doesn't seem to feel as present and as real, which is why the idea that you offered about migrant, the etymology of the name migrant, resonated so deeply for me. I was wondering if you might tell us about the etymology of the word migrant, how it came to be. You talked about it in the book, how it came to be, and then how it came to be a very human term.
Yeah, the word migrant, I'm going to try and find the page real quick, but I'm not sure.
I think 88.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. The word migrant, indeed, first appeared in the English language in the 17th century as an adjective for animals that are changing place, mm-hmm. and was not used to describe humans until a congregational minister did in 1807, writing about the colonial history of New Hampshire. Its very etymology dehumanizes the non-settled. The comparison persists. In 2015, the New York Times wrote of the photographer Rocco Rondelli's documentation of human movement from the air, "His photos are reminiscent of aerial images of the migration of herds." 2 years later, President Trump said of some migrants, "These aren't people, they are animals."
So from animal to human.
To animal.
To animal.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wondering if you might talk a little bit about your experience of migration. How real has that comparison been for the people that you've seen in your life who've been migrants, or for your own migration story?
Well, my own migration story, I'm a very privileged migrant. I moved to the United States when I was 28. I had a job at an American newspaper. I was the Moscow bureau chief of the San Francisco Chronicle mm-hmm. in Russia. And then when I moved as the war correspondent for the San Francisco Chronicle. I moved to Massachusetts. And like a good white pilgrim, I ended up in Plymouth. The rest is history. the propaganda, I'll call it propaganda, right? The bigotry that saturates this culture is such that 2 years later, I was visiting friends in Dallas, And they said, hey, there's this project to collect stories of immigrants, of migrants, oral histories. Mm-hmm. Maybe you should go and donate your history. And I was like, me? Because I was already diseased with the stereotype because I didn't fit it.
Right.
So I was. So it took me a little bit to recalibrate. Mm-hmm. Right. So that was my reminder. I also, because I was a war correspondent for many years, witnessed people, you know, walking to safety. I witnessed people taking lorries to safety or to perceived safety. I saw refugee camps. So there is a refugee camp in Jordan that has been there since, in Amman, Jordan, that has been there since 1947, mm-hmm. Which is a very long time for people to live. Generations were born there. Mm-hmm. There is a refugee camp on the border between Somalia and Kenya, or rather in Kenya proper, but mm-hmm. It's a refugee camp that holds tens of thousands of people, and also for years, decades. So there are people who are in this state of waiting for some kind of resolution. Mm-hmm. But what we don't, but again, these are kind of cartoonish images almost. What sure. we don't realize is that one in seven people on the planet has left their birthplace and is living someplace else. Absolutely. Not necessarily across in a different country, mm-hmm. And not necessarily unsuccessfully.
Right.
Right? But this historic mistrust of the migrant by the settled persists. You know, it's an ancient thing.
Sure.
And at least in the European culture, Greeks called Greeks only the people who were born in Greece and only of specific origin, mm-hmm. and the rest were barbarians. Mm-hmm. And the word barbarian is believed to be a word that originated from the mimicking of the sound that sheep make, speaking of animals. Dumb sheep. Mm. Blah, 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 blah. Mm-hmm. Those are barbarians mm-hmm. who can't speak. We can't understand them.
Right.
In Russian, the word for Germans, which used to be the word to denote all Western foreigners, has the root in not knowing how to speak. Mm. So, again, strangers who don't know how to speak. It's a very human trait to dehumanize the migrant.
It truly is. But one of the things I noticed in your book was, just in the passage you just read, there was a humanizing measure in your language because you said the non-settled. Mm-hmm. And at the point that I read that, I thought to myself, well, who isn't non-settled? Mm-hmm. We're all non-settled to some degree. So it was this point of embracing that fact that to some degree we are all mm-hmm. moving and migrating and having some pattern of movement in our lives. And I think that was also the point in my reading where I said, oh, Anna is a poet. It's clear that this woman is a poet.
Well, since you are the poet laureate of Philadelphia, I take it as...
The language was
the
so...
The utmost compliment.
Your handling of image, your language was so vivid. It was as if you, as a reader, as if you're there. So I wanted to ask, how does poetry inform your work? Because it's very clear as a reader who reads a lot of poetry that I'm reading poetry in prose form. At least in my opinion, as I read your work. How does that inform your work? What does the work of the how does the work of the poet inform these socio-political issues that you're bringing up in your books?
Thank you. But first, can I get a ribbon that says honorary poet?
Oh, absolutely. Since, now, I'll give
you
a medal.
Do you have the power?
I'll make it, yes.
Excellent. Excellent. I'll send it to my parents. Well, poets are amazing because you have to use so few words and so many silences. Mm. So this extremely parsimonious way with words is a huge source of learning for me. This is not my native language. So I have to be extremely careful with it, lest I mess up and somebody says, well, she can't even, you know, write in English. So I consider language a tool. There is a traditional Russian art, a folk art, in which you take one takes a log, mm-hmm. and then turns this entire log into this beautiful bird with wings that have like individual feathers almost. Mm. So it's extremely fine work with an axe.
Wow.
So that's kind of what I feel like I'm doing. I have an axe, and I'm trying to use it to precision chisel something meaningful with this fairly crude instrument. So how do I use this tool that I'm borrowing, because it's borrowed language, or because language is always borrowed, maybe. Mm-hmm. But how do I use this tool to make something beautiful? And I think that's what poets do best. So I learn all the time about how to use silences and how to use specific words. Mm. I'm much better on paper, trust me, than
I don't know if that's true. I think you're beautiful in both.
Thank you.
There was something that was said in the book, and I know we have to open it up for questions, but there was something that was said in the book, and I have to ask you this. So it talked about in Islam, the word for predetermination and book are the same.
Mm. Same root. Yes.
The same root. Yeah. And so thinking about every book as a foretelling, a prophecy to some degree, what did this book tell you? What are you learning now that you didn't know then, but the book told you?
Write more books. Well, you know, this is not a book of answers. Mm. This is a book of questions. Mm-hmm. So maybe the book told me to ask more better questions, better questions, mm-hmm. in the next one. You know, maybe it's just too young. It's a newborn right now, so it's really hard to kind of divin out of it what it says. What I hope it says to readers who are not me, what I hope it actually, I don't know that I wanted to say anything. I know that I want to provoke other questions. Mm-hmm. I want it kind of to be, I think that there are a lot of threads in this book,
sure.
that one can grab onto and kind of begin pulling on. Mm-hmm. And I want to kind of know, maybe I just want to know that readers will unspool them in their own way and follow their own rabbit warrens and follow their own threads into their own imaginations and to their own astonishments.
Yeah, it is definitely a book of awe. Mm. One of those books that you read and you say, you leave with questions. And I love those types of books where you can leave the text and still wonder after you've closed the binding. And so I think that you've gifted the world with that, with this book. And I'm so honored to be here and to talk about
Thank
it
you.
With you. Yeah. I know that I have a bunch of questions for Anna, but I know that I have to share the time. So I wanted to open it up for any of you to ask questions.
Thank you. I am enjoying this book, and I rarely read a new book, but I pre-ordered it, and I was just astonished that so much is local. The chapter, How to Read the Air, is about incidents that happened in my neighborhood in West Philly. Mm. And it's it was a really intense time in Philadelphia in general. The whole year was just intense. I actually had my first heart attack on the day after George Floyd was murdered, and I feel like there was just like the country was just going through so much. Walter Wallace's murder was a very different thing from George Floyd's murder, and you use the word lynched by police officers, which I don't object to, but the term itself is such a loaded term and so provocative that I would like you to think or respond or meditate on the spectacle of lynching, because people in another city might not know the story of Walter Wallace, but George Floyd's murder was such a lynching because it included the spectacle of the YouTube video that many people watched. And you seem to be aware of things being magnified through the media. And I'm just curious how lynching is a word and the choice of words you use, or lynch, is just such a loaded historical American term. And it can be cheapened, like Clarence Thomas, in my opinion, cheapened the term when he referred to his questioning as a legal lynching, for example. So I'm just going to stop talking. But your choice of words in an essay is very important. And to say he was lynched, the police officers, who you also described as racist, I don't know if they were white or black. I don't know. The police are terrible. Philadelphia has a long tradition of police violence. I'm going to stop talking, but it's very nice to meet you, Anna. My name's Timmy.
Hi, Timmy. It's nice to meet you also. Thank you for your question. I'm going to take on the responsibility of declaring every police murder of a black man in this country lynching. I hope that answers your question.
Just say your name, if you will, please.
Yeah, hi, I'm Mordecai. I have the privilege of knowing Anna via a program we're both in to study fiction writing. And since you mentioned poetry and its effect on Anna's work, I was wondering if Anna could speak to what perhaps you are hoping to find in fiction, which I know is sort of out there in the future for you.
Thank you for the question. Thanks for coming. I think I hope to find more questions. Fiction is a new field for me, so I have a lot of questions about it. I hope that it's kind of like getting a new axe. So we'll see what kind of bird it chisels out.
You come at this work with an obvious empathy, right, and a deep curiosity. I wonder if you also struggle with the potential tension of your own role as voyeur. And how that plays out for you.
Sure. Can I have your name, please?
Heidi.
Heidi. Nice to meet you, Heidi. Thank you for the question. I do struggle with my own role as a voyeur and my positionality and my privilege more and more. And that may be one of the reasons I'm very curious about fiction, because I want to know what kind of shortcut it allows for me. I, in general, struggle with my great fortune of, you know, being here. I know that there are a lot of people in the world who write books. I know that not a lot of people have them published. I know that not a lot of people get to speak from stage to other people and, you know, share a stage with amazing poets. So I think what my particular privilege as a published writer, as a white woman with an American passport, encourages me to do is to be extremely demanding of myself about how I use that privilege. And also there is also decades old communities and relationships and friendships. I wasn't always a carrier of an American passport, and I grew up, you know, in a very kind of different dynamic, power dynamic. So the way I interpret it, because I want to interpret it this way, is an imperative, a marching order, an obligation to use language and use this stage to bring the world to some kind of accountability. Sometimes it feels like I'm succeeding, and sometimes it feels like I'm just, fooling around. Mm. And it can happen on the same day. It's kind of like a bipolar situation with my relationship with power, which I think is okay.
I have one question that I want to ask in the interim. You talked about in your last statement or your last answer your intersections of identity. Mm. And how you think about defining yourself. And we do know that your voice reaches through the storytelling, telling stories about marginalized folks, telling stories about the forgotten. Who do you want to reach? At your intersection, who is it important for you to reach? Or does the intersection not even matter?
Is this the same question as whom am I writing for?
Yeah. Mm.
I don't know. I think I know the answer to the question, whom do I want to please? And that's my conscience. Mm. I don't know the answer to the question, who. I'm so astonished every time somebody reads my book. I want everybody to. So there's, it doesn't. We're not necessarily logical species, right? We all agree that we're completely unfair and weird. And so I want everybody to read my book.
Sure.
Right. I want it to be, I want it to be like Jericho Brown on bus stops, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. I love Jericho Brown, and he should be on every bus stop. But I don't have in mind a particular person reading it. I imagine that the person who would be reading it is smarter than me and better than me. Hmm. That is what I always imagine. I don't know who that person is, abstract, but I imagine that that person knows more, is better, a better human, is, more ethical, has a stronger moral compass, and is more demanding of the world. And I want them to not throw my book into the fire because it's such shit, right? Mm-hmm. Because it's so off. That's my kind of writer's scary thing.
Right.
Like, that's what I scare myself with.
Right.
That's the reader right. that I want to say, good.
I think that's the reader that you're going to get. honestly, your attention to the human draws the human. Mm. And so as you pay attention to your gaze, you pay acute attention to these human experiences that we all feel and interact with on a daily basis, but don't necessarily put words to. Mm. And so you enact the human experience on the page. And for that, I would just add that humans are your audience, because it's a very human experience that we have with this book. I also want to ask you another quick question. I know that I'm going to open it back up so you can ask questions too. But I can't help but notice you have a finely attuned eye for detail. You notice everything. And that, I think, in the age in which the age of technology, or what I call like the sense age of sight, we're always paying attention to everything but what we should be paying attention to, we're distracted. How do you hone that skill of attention? How do you pay attention and hone in on the one that's in front of you?
Oh, I'm very nearsighted. So that's all I can see.
That'll help.
I, I don't know. I don't know that I'm paying attention to the things I should be paying attention to. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm glad it pleases you. I'm glad it pleases you. I think on a more serious note, but also kind of wacky note. So humans, most humans, have a certain... They have a certain degree of pattern recognition, right? Some humans don't, but most humans do. And some humans have a stronger sense of pattern, and some humans have less strong sense of pattern. Artists generally tend to have a very strong sense of pattern recognition. The next stage is, you know, prophets. All they see is, you know, pattern. In the birds, and you know, in the spilled coffee grains, mm-hmm. and so we're just kind of like one step behind, almost deranged. So I notice things that I notice because I'm deranged in this particular way, mm-hmm. right? And I'm very lucky that there are enough people who are deranged in a similar way, who understand my derangement, or are at least willing to play along with. Nobody wants to live in this book. Mm-hmm. You all want to read it, thank you. Mm-hmm. It's a very good book, so says the Poet Laureate of Philadelphia.
It's very true. It's marvelous.
But you don't want to be in it all the time, mm-hmm. because that is crazy-making. And I don't want to be in it all the time. Mm-hmm. That's why I also take walks, run in the morning, you know, have dinner with friends, mm-hmm. Do regular stuff, mm-hmm. Take out the trash. But there is, I'm going to bring up Jericho Brown again. Jericho Brown once said at one of his readings, he said, somebody asked him how he came up with his latest collection, and he said, I went back through my notes for the last 6 years and saw what I was thinking about. Because mm-hmm. you don't know what you're thinking about until you go and look at it from, you know, from God's eye, mm-hmm. bird's eye view. Mm-hmm. You kind of zoom out and say, huh, I'm really interested. So I realized after reading this book for Audible in 2 days, so 2 sessions, I realized, oh my God, I'm really interested in birds. There's so many mm-hmm. birds in this book, different kinds of birds. I think you can play a game, like find the bird, or how many birds can you find in the book? Which kinds of birds? I had no idea that I was really interested. I know that I like birds, but this is next degree. So I think there are just things that catch my eye. I really like that color, for example, that you're wearing, the mustard yellow. It's a beautiful color.
It's also the color of...
Thank you. And so, like, I have a thing. So I'll notice it.
Yeah.
You know, and I will notice it in a particular way. Mm-hmm. Because of my life, because of the focus of my work, I've been a writer of one kind or another for 27 years. There have been particular subjects that I have spent more time writing about than others. I haven't written mm-hmm. a whole lot about education, but I've written a lot about food, for example, right? Mm-hmm. Probably because I like to eat well. And so I like birds, apparently. I'm interested in place. I'm interested in love. I'm interested in prayer for many different reasons. Mm-hmm. So these are probably the things that I keep noticing, or try to keep noticing even, with my myopic eyes.
Right on. And is it that you sometimes find that you can't stop noticing those things?
That's why I have a therapist.
Yeah. We all need one. It's a good thing.
Yes, I agree.
I want to open it back up to the audience if anyone has any last questions.
Hi, I'm Juno. So you said your book is a book of questions and not answers. So my question is, what is the question to the answer about the thread of talking about how humans respond to boundaries, therefore bleeding over to how we, the big we, react to migrants? And specifically, of course, it makes me think of the language you referred to, the language if you don't speak the language. And we all are aware of the, you know, the conversation, if you can call it that, around speaking anything but English is not looked upon positively in this country. So what is the question that can lead to how we as humans get through our thoughts, get through all our boundaries, from the boundary of this is my room, this is my house, this is my yard, this is my city, my state, my country, et cetera, to not treat, you know, to make some level of progress.
Mm. Yes, I think this book does address all of these questions with its own questions. I'm serious. I think that this book... Well, I do mean read the book, obviously, but I mean, Uncle Bobby's is a wonderful shop, and they sent a human person who's sitting outside all this time with books, so just, you know. But, I think that there are... that I ask these questions in the book, and I come up with many, maybe non sequiturs, maybe like koanic almost situations, where you ask me that question, and I say, look, a bird. But look, a bird is one way. I think noticing, so if I can rephrase your question, and you can tell me if I'm very far off, but I think the question is, where do we draw hope that we can improve, right? Is that kind of the question? Is the question about our capacity for improvement? Yes, okay. So I think if you go in your mind to a church in Lalibela in Ethiopia, which was hewn out of rock on the order of a king who dreamed that he must build these churches out of rock in Lalibela. Several churches hewn out of rock with tools that are like this big, kind of like these scrapey things. Massive churches, huge, kind of hewn down into the mountain. And if you enter a church, and it's granite, I think, or basalt, the rock, it's reddish. And if you enter the church, everything inside is stone. And if you look at the wall, you will see that up until like this level, the walls have a certain darker sheen to them. And then higher up to the ceiling, they're just rock. And the sheen comes from the oil from the palms of 900 years of people who had pilgrimed to these churches in hope for something that they were experiencing, that they wanted to go away, or they wanted to come, or they wanted to improve. And just imagine the 900 years of hoping that has left its mark on this wall of a church. And imagine now that we have been here for 300,000 years-ish. And something has carried us all the way to now, despite plagues, wars, floods, droughts, terrible devastations, because we always found something to hold on to and something to look forward to. So that I think is the bird that I want you to look at. That idea that there is something to be astonished about and something to love. And also the idea that we have the capacity for compassion. We have the capacity for love. We have the capacity to be kind to one another. Otherwise, we would have exterminated one another a long time ago, right? Mm-hmm. So here we are all in this room. Not everybody knows everybody else.
an hour has gone by and everybody's still alive. And the idea that we can do this step by step, right, and carry this light with us and share this light with someone else and share the hoping. I think that's as close as I can come to an answer and as close as I can come to a prophet without being institutionalized backstage. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. From that answer, I came up with a question, which was, can we hope together? And that was the question that I kind of mm-hmm. left the text mm-hmm. with. Is it possible that we can hope together? There was this one passage, and I'm going to paraphrase. It was talking about proximity breeds empathy, like the need to be close to something in order to empathize with it, and the need to be within speaking distance of it. Mm-hmm. And so I'm hoping that through the conversations in these book, in your book, and these essays, that we start to think about how do we move closer to one another? Mm. How do we speak, become within speaking distance of one another? How do we get closer? How do we become proximal subjects rather than these distant, look at the bird. Like, how do we get closer to that?
Yeah, I love that.
And so thank you for this so much, Anna. Thank you for this book. Thank you all for coming out. What an incredible evening. And
thank you.
I was wondering if you might leave us with just reading a passage of your choice from the book.
Of course.
Any passage?
Any passage here. Hang on a second.
We are back on the straight paved road east to Nouakchott. Now, after walking for days through so much stillness, the sensation of being transported at an accelerated speed numbs the mind. Barkhan's safe chains, regs, scarps, pale meadows of dry grass like fuzz on a plucked chicken, oases blink past. Suddenly, on the road, a large herd of camels. Some are merrily daled calves, wobbly and puppyish. The drivers slow down. The metal carapaces of our trucks jostle past the camel's animal confusion, and when we pass their sole herder, I remember the terror several years earlier in Mali of walking with a herd of zebus upon an unexpected tarmac that guillotined fast and merciless through the sandy scrubland just south of the Sahara, and watching helplessly the dreadful road split the bullish herd in two. The herder, a 17-year-old boy named Hassan, the youngest son of a friend, scarecrowed madly in his blue robes to force the animals off the asphalt just in time for a silver SUV to whiz by toward Bamako. A war was raging up the road, and the car had a bullet hole in the trunk door. The air quivered in its wake, the scent of hot tar billowed, stilled once more, and the rest of the cows lowered their heads as they crossed. Born and bred in seasonal migrations through thorn and sand and periodic grasslands since the beginning of time, the animals made up all of Hassan's family wealth, and his family's entire remembered history was branded into their pale rumps. The hooves' purchase on pavement was uncertain as when crossing a marble floor in stiletto heels. Meteorite shrapnel spilling on a reg must sound like this. And as our all-wheel drives finally pull out of the camel herd and speed up again toward the Atlantic coast, toward Nouakchott, I think, as I thought then, that there is something immoral about a well-paved road and about the speed of departure to which many of us have subjugated our lives. I remember Hassan's shoes on that day, narrow, plastic, turquoise $2 lace-ups with thick soles, scrawled over with phone numbers in ballpoint pen. On Sahara's southern shore, men often wrote phone numbers on their footwear, contacts of relatives, of middlemen, of lovers they have left behind, to be dialed when needed or when possible from a borrowed phone. Their shoes were dossiers, telephone books, annals of connection, impenetrable by thorn or time or termite. Consider farewells in global terms. A great number of us has said goodbye to someone else, and as we part from the people who are meaningful and close, or were, or could be, or could have been, we carry with us our kinship's map legends, the tokens of our connections, as Hassan carried on his first ever solo dry season cattle drive, a stoppered gourd with his mother's millet couscous, a blue tarp wrapped with lengths of lasso his elder brother has given him, the family's black milking calabash, his father's blessing, and his phone book shoes. Like many men in the bush, Hassan did not write names next to the numbers because, like many men in the bush, he was unlettered, so he had to memorize to whom each number belonged. But I have never seen a man dial a wrong number, because each number signifies a particular kinship stored just so in the immeasurable library of the heart, in the ever-expanding breast, in each specific part of the shoe, left and right toe box, vamp, quarter, heel counter, corresponding to a distinct thread of devotion a traveler will carry across any parting and any distance without confusion, just as I, without confusion and across any distance, carry on the underside of my eyelids the face of the one I love.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for coming. Thank you, Era. Thank you, Free Library.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.